Hello, I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Coming up after the news, it's Philosophy Talk.
Today's topic, happiness. Ken, what makes you happy?
Oh, talking philosophy with you, John. Watching my son play baseball and doing good deeds, making the world a better place makes me happy.
Oh, Ken, you're so high-minded. But if all of those high-minded things make you happy, isn't it just because they give you pleasure? I mean, drinking beer gives me pleasure. It's not high-minded, but that's what makes me happy.
You're so low-minded, John. But those things might make you happy, but pleasure can't just be happiness. I mean, a lot of creeps have pleasure, and they take pleasure in awful things.
Like reading mystery novels or eating chocolates. You're such a snob, Ken. I think you're digging far too deep into happiness to ever be truly happy.
Happiness happens when Philosophy Talk continues after the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW Information Radio in San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that started Philosophy Corner at Stanford University.
Yeah, where a bunch of philosophers sit around and ecstatically discuss things like happiness.
Happiness, contemplative people, contemplating contemplation. Sounds wonderful. But now let's start at the top with happiness. Happiness is presumably an emotion, right?
Okay.
State people are in, sometimes for a little while, sometimes for a long while. Now, philosophers usually think that emotions have two parts, two aspects. There's the feeling and the thought. For example, if I'm frightened, there will be a feeling of being scared, a certain tightness. There'll also be a thought, maybe that a lion is coming after me or my boss is going to fire me. If you just had the feeling without the thought, it would just be kind of free-floating anxiety. So if we take that idea, what do you think the feeling and the thoughts connected with being happy are, Ken?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure I take that idea, but I'll accept it for the moment. Here's a thought. Okay, there's two different kinds of happiness, at least two different kinds of happiness. I could be happy that something happened, happy that George Bush is about to lose the election, say. So the thought is George Bush is about to lose the election, and the feeling is, I guess, pleasure at that thought. You know, but there's also not just momentary happiness, but happiness with my life. Are you happy? You know, and then I sort of contemplate my life, and I have this kind of feeling of pleasure at the contemplation of the state of my life overall.
I just want to get straight about a detail here. Can you haven't got some recent news that he's going to lose the Republican nomination? Have you?
No. Just so, checking. I mean, what do you think about that?
Okay, so there's transitory happiness, and then there's more the state of being happy. Transitory happiness might be because of some particular thing you've just found out, or some particular pleasure you're having. You're happy because you're just eating some chocolate, and it tastes so good, and who could not be happy while you're eating chocolate. But then I say, well, why are you eating chocolate? Well, because I'm deeply unhappy. That's a different concept of happiness or a different type of happiness. It's not so transitory. It's long-term. It has to do more with your whole situation in life. Am I getting you right?
Yeah, you're getting me right. Now it looks like we've solved the entire problem of happiness right here and there. You know, I mean, we said happiness is pleasure at the thought of something. That doesn't quite, like, it can't be all there is to it.
But the account you gave makes it sound like you have to have a positive view about your life to be happy. So some mafiosa hired killer can't be happy, but they certainly might seem pretty happy.
If he's a real creep, he might take pleasure at the thought of his murderous life. But, you know, that's kind of, I don't know what to say about that. I mean, maybe he doesn't deserve, he might be happy, but the question is whether he deserves to be happy, you know. John, I asked my wife this question that we're going to talk about this morning. I said, honey, what is happiness? And you know what she said to me? That's a really hard question. I don't know. I can only tell you what makes me happy. I can't tell you what happiness is.
I asked my wife what happiness was, and she says it's you going down, getting the coffee and breakfast and bringing it up to me in bed. Let's find out what other people think happiness is.
Yeah, and to find out, we'll consult our roving philosophical reporter who talked to lots of people about their views about happiness. She files this report.
Last summer, radio producer Tanya Katenjian drove across the country, asking people she met along the way a question. What is happiness?
Happiness is having a picnic every day and a party every night and always smiling. Have a good time and never meet a stranger.
A wonderful woman, a nice warm bed, good meal, good friends. If you got that, you got the world.
I enjoy golfing. I enjoy boating.
Ranching. Horseback riding all the time. Got probably a the best horse in the state of Wisconsin. Not bragging on you that much, but he is good.
So the five things that make me happy are walking, talking, touching, tasting, loving, life. I have a greater appreciation for it because it was almost snatched away from me.
I sell ice cream bar. If I can sell one, it makes me happy.
Money, but not a lot of money, you know? You gotta have money to do things.
Nice rainstorm, smell of the ocean.
My children, and old people. I've really got a thing about old people. Love them to bits.
My health is good. I'm happy with what I do for a living and the place that I live at, you know, South Dakota. This is fabulous up here. You couldn't ask for anything better.
You can always be more happy than you are right now, even if you're happy right now.
My wife is right there, smiling at me. That makes me happy. That's the most important thing in my life right there. And that pretty much sums it up.
You have a choice to be happy or not to be happy. If you choose to be happy, then I think happiness finds you.
For Philosophy Talk, this is Amy Standen.
I'm John Perry, here with Ken Taylor. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today's topic, happiness. Ken, we just heard from a lot of people, mostly telling us about what made them happy, and most talking about feelings or the situations that cause feelings. Very little about thoughts. I'm not sure that our philosophical conception of happiness is involving both thought and feeling is one that's kind of shared by the general public.
Yeah, well, you might be right about that. But then, you know, the general public is often wrong. So that's another. But we have a guest today who's going to help straighten us, help us straighten this out. That's Professor Robert Solomon of the University of Texas. Professor Solomon has published extensively on the philosophy of the emotions, including his recent book, Thinking About Feeling, Contemporary Philosophers on Emotion. He joins us from station KUT in Austin. Bob, it's a pleasure having you with us. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
I'm happy to be here.
Hi, Bob. John Perry.
You ask me what that means.
Well, that's about what I was about to do. Help us out with our basic geography here, Bob. Is happiness a feeling, a feeling plus a thought, an emotion? Is it just pleasure? What do you think about it? You've thought long and deeply about it.
I'd say none of the above.
None of the above. Okay,
oh, well. So we're off to a bad start already.
If you listen to your various interviewees, most of them named either doing things or things. They didn't talk about experience, although obviously they were conscious at the time. They didn't talk about pleasure as such. They didn't talk about the good life or thoughts about the good life. It really came down to this is what makes me happy. And I think there's real insight there. I think philosophers get it wrong. One thing I think that shows is that it's highly dubious that happiness is pleasure.
But Bob, I mean, they're talking about what makes them happy, but doesn't that mean that there's different things that produce the same state in lots of different people, and it's that state that produces its happiness? Or am I being too philosophical?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing that my wife said to me this morning. I said, what is happiness, sweetheart? And she said, I can't tell you that, but I can just tell you what makes me happy. But she knew she wasn't answering the question.
Right. Well, I don't think it's a single state either. I think we go wrong when we think of it as an emotion. I mean, first distinction to make is one that you've already made between there's a kind of transitory state or experience, and then there is a much longer term view of your life. Seems to me that Aristotle was right when he says the only sense of happiness that really means anything is the long-term view of your life.
So Aristotle wasn't keen on transitory happiness. He didn't think that I refuted Plato this morning, that really made me happy. Was really getting at the core.
I mean, that may
I don't
be
think it even occurred to him.
That may be a deeper thing, the long-term non-transitory happiness that you can only decide that you've had once your life is over. But, I mean, living in the moment, you think, I mean, what do you think about? Well, what will I think when I'm dead, when I'm about to die, about this whole life that I'm living? You think, well, what makes this moment a special moment, a happiness-making moment, a joy-constituting moment? We live moment to moment, don't we?
Let me come back to that, because I think Aristotle has a much more radical view. he weighs the question whether it makes sense to call a person happy even when he's dead.
Yeah.
And, of course, he's not talking about experience after death, but he's thinking about happiness in terms of the fulfillment of the desires you have when you're alive, the aspirations, and so on, so that if your children in Aristotle's time were accused of treason after you were dead, you would be unhappy because your aspiration to have your children be noble citizens was thwarted.
So was he thinking of you as living on in some afterlife and being unhappy when you find out about that, or just kind of you're dead and gone, but somehow your happiness state changes with the future? That's an interesting idea.
Right. Well, it's a way of saying that happiness has an objective component.
Uh-huh.
That to talk about a person's happiness is not to talk about how they feel or how they think about their lives, so much as it's to talk about how well their life has gone.
So we're appealing here to a distinction between the subjective, which is what goes on in my own mind and just depends on me and the existence of my mind. So my feelings, my thoughts, not the truth of my thoughts, but just my having my thoughts, versus the objective, what the world is really like. I may have a thought, but is it true or not? That's a question about objectivity. And you're saying that thoughts and feelings can't be happiness because happiness has this objective side, if I understand it right.
Well, that's certainly what Aristotle would say. I'd say even if you sort of water down the objectivity, you've still got a problem with just thoughts and feelings. For one thing, self-deception is pretty rife in this area. Americans in particular live in a culture where you're supposed to be happy most of the time. Mm-hmm. Think of the Pepsi generation commercials and so on. And so most Americans, if you ask them, are you happy, will say yes, and then they'll quickly manufacture some reasons why they are. This is even the case when you can just watch them briefly and see that they are fairly miserable people. So I think people often think that they're happy when they're not.
So you don't think the happiness is like tastes good? I mean, if it tastes good to me, it tastes good. I mean, there's no like, you can't say, well, that doesn't taste good to you. You're just deceiving yourself. I mean, that it seems a little odd for an outside party to criticize your claims about your likes and dislikes. Right. But you think it can make sense to say you think you're happy, but you're not, because I have better access to what than you do. I mean, if happiness is about, you know, my pleasures and pains, the presence of pleasure, enduring deep, intense pleasure in the absence of pains, then who's the authority on it except me?
Well, but I think certainly you have to bring in something like satisfaction. When the people you interviewed talked about enjoying doing certain things or going through certain sorts of things, again, of course, the fact that their experiences was presupposed. But I think the idea of enjoying the doing is very different from simply experiencing pleasure. And if you think of, this is again Aristotle, if you think of pleasure as a kind of experience that you have while you're enjoying something or while you're doing something you enjoy, then you break up the experience in an unintelligible way. Enjoying doing something may or may not give you pleasure as such, but pleasure is not a distinct experience.
Let me go back just a minute. You brought up self-deception, which I think is very interesting, and made the point that most Americans are pretty convinced they're happy, even if they're not, because we're supposed to be happy. And that seems right to me. I think we can deceive ourselves about whether we're happy. How about the other way around? The great philosopher Barney, the green dinosaur or whatever he was, used to say, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. So there's an implicit distinction there. He says it's the other way around. He thinks you can be happy, but think you're not happy. Then you wouldn't clap your hands even if you're happy. Is he right about that?
I think that's clearly true.
All right, so both sides. You can be wrong. You can think you're happy when you're not, and you can think you're unhappy when you're actually happy.
Right. And I think that's where the question about what is happiness becomes really serious, because Aristotle, again, would say something like, well, of course, the happy life includes lots of moments of pleasure and so on. But it isn't just that. But one of the philosophers I take just as seriously is the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. And Nietzsche, who people have all sorts of distorted views about, which I'm not going to talk about, but Nietzsche had a very romantic, artistic view of life. And there was a sense in which he talks about something that might be thought of as happiness, but it certainly doesn't consist either of many moments of pleasure or moments of satisfaction. The life of an artist is almost by definition filled with dissatisfaction, always wanting more, wanting better, and so on. And it seems to me that I don't want to rule out that kind of romantic life and seemed perfectly plausible to me to say that someone, a really screwed up artist like Van Gogh or Gauguin or whatever, in a sense, had a perfectly flourishing life. I want to be careful about the word
Bob,
happiness.
Bob, let's take that up some more after in a little bit.
Okay.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our guest today is Professor Robert Solomon of the University of Texas. We're going to open up the phone lines now. You can give us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. We're talking about, what is happiness? Is it just a feeling? Is it just based on experience? Or is it doing well and being well in some objective sense?
How do you define the good life, the life of a truly happy person? 415-841-4134. Or you can go to our website, philosophytalk.org, and send us a comment. We may or may not get it, given the state of the Internet.
But Philosophy Talk will be right back.
Forget your troubles, come on, get happy. You better chase all your cares away. Shout hallelujah, come on, get happy. Get ready for the judgment day. The sun is shining, come on, get happy. The Lord is
Judy Garland singing Get Happy. We're back on Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're talking about happiness with Professor Robert Solomon of the University of Texas at Austin.
Join us. The phone lines are opening up, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Bob, just before the break, you were saying something about the artist, the struggling, angst-ridden artist, deeply engaged with his artistic creation, living, being happy. I mean, I'd wonder, why use the term happiness? I mean, he might be, or she might be engaged, might be striving, but why call that happiness if it's a life devoid of, you know, the pleasure in some
sense. The void is, I think, too strong.
Okay.
I mean, Nietzsche had moments of real ecstasy when he listened to music and so on. But it seems to me that this whole idea of a flourishing life with a certain kind of objective component is brought out by a certain kind of thought experiment that's been bouncing around philosophy for a long time. And there are two versions of this. The simple one was thought of by Robert Nozick, among others, about 20 years ago. It's the idea of a contraption. You put yourself in it, electrodes are attached to your head, you are given waves of pleasure. This is completely voluntary, you can get out of the box anytime you want. The fact is, nobody ever gets out of the box. So the question for the listener is, would you be willing to do that if you were pretty sure that you would spend the rest of your life in the box? And most people flatly say no.
Right.
The second version, which is much more interesting, is suppose same kind of contraption, but now instead of just giving you waves of pleasure, it made you think that all of your desires were satisfied. And that could include, for example, the desire to be the greatest artist in the world.
Mm-hmm.
In your thoughts and so on, you would be convinced that that has become true. But of course, it's not. And then you ask people, would you get into that box? And most of them will still say no. Now, what does that show? It seems to me that most people feel, as Aristotle again said, that the happy life has to be one of activity and actually doing things.
That sounds right. That sounds plausible to me in one way. But in another way, I think it's loading too much into happiness. I mean, why not say the good life has to be a life of activity, doing things? Happiness, as many people understand it, is a life of pleasure in the doing of those things. That's one component of the good life, but it's not the only component. And then there's competing goods. You know, you want to be happy on the one hand, but you also want to do good, achieve things, you know. Happiness isn't the only term of evaluation by which we honor a life as good. So,
Let me follow this up by giving another example. It's similar to yours, but it makes a little more of the connection between happiness and truth, or the disconnection. Suppose you had a kid. I think it's due to Philip or Foote, but I'll put a little bit different spin on it. Suppose you have a kid that just wants to be a successful oilman in the worst way, but he really doesn't have the talent to do it. But you, as his fabulously wealthy father, just set up the world so that it seems to him like he's succeeding. As far as he can tell, he's a very successful oilman. Every time his wells go dry, somebody pays him a lot of money for the company, and is he happy? I'm inclined to say he's happy, but he's happy because he's deluded. We wouldn't choose that, but if we are in that, it's a slightly different question. If we're in the situation, are we happy?
So Bob, what do you say in response to Kent, John and I?
I would like to say it's a completely unrealistic example, but I'm afraid I can't.
Well, you're from Texas, so you've probably heard of people like this.
Yeah, right. But anyway.
I'm sitting here in a studio about 50 yards away from where he...
So, the hypothetical person.
but the point I think John and I are both making is that, you know, happiness is one good among others. Sometimes it's not so great, you know, but you're still happy. It's not such a good. I mean, if you purchase your happiness at the cost of delusion, I mean, is the happiness a good or not? I mean, but it's still happiness, perhaps.
I think, again, we've hit a sort of basic ambiguity because when Aristotle defines what is often translated as happiness, he makes it pretty clear that happiness is the name of whatever the good life consists in.
Mm-hmm.
So that doesn't really give you any content. And then he goes on for hundreds of pages to try and tell you what the content might be. So on the one hand, happiness is just whatever the good life is. On the other hand, happiness, and here you're moving towards the sort of feeling experience view, happiness is one component. What I'm aiming at is something that's in between, something that's a little bit less objective and all-embracing than Aristotle, but something that's much more than a feeling or a simple experience. The phrase subjective well-being has been tossed around by many psychologists in the recent decades to cover this.
Yeah. Let's see what some of our callers think. Tanya in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Tanya.
Hi. I just tuned in, and it's something that I've been pondering on for quite a bit, and I kind of disagree with your, well, I don't disagree with your point of view, but I can disagree with the point of view that takes into consideration objective set of norms or objective set of criteria, I guess, identifying somebody's happiness. I guess happiness is very internal to a person, and I come from a different background. I didn't grow up in the States. I've come across with people from different geographic origins.
Where did you grow up, Tanya?
In former Soviet Union. To tell you the truth, what we've considered happiness there at that time is completely different from what people consider happiness or somebody being happy over there at this time and over here at this time. And
give us some examples of what would count but doesn't now, or would have counted but doesn't now, or does there but doesn't here.
It comes down to the amount of material health wasn't such a big issue there then among an older population as it is now. So having yourself a treatment for a certain ailment now is a great thing, and you would jump for joy if you get it.
Tanya, thank you for the call. There's one thing to say that what makes people happy varies from culture to culture, time to time, context to context. I mean, back in the caveman days, you know, a nice cave would have made people happy. But now it takes, I don't know, in Silicon Valley, it takes a huge, way overpriced house, I guess, or something like that. So it varies from culture to culture. But that's not the same distinction, is it, Bob, as the sort of subjective-objective distinction, I wouldn't think.
Well,
what do you think?
No, and also the idea that there's an objective component to happiness doesn't mean that there's a single set of norms. You can allow for lots of cultural variability here. So what would count as being happy in Japan is not what counts as being happy in Texas, and what counts as being happy in the Soviet Union is not what counts today in contemporary Russia.
So, and you're not denying that when you talk about the objective component, right? So
right.
How do you reconcile the idea that there's this cultural variability with this objectivity thing you were talking about? How do those two things fit together?
Because I think happiness is a kind of all-encompassing conception of how well you're doing in life, the kinds of experiences you're having, the sort of satisfactions you're enjoying, the sorts of aspirations and how they're going. And, of course, those are going to be very different from culture to culture, but nevertheless, it seems to me that they do have an objective component insofar as in a particular culture or a subculture, there are ways of measuring them, and you can be wrong. I mean, it seems to me self-deception is a very key element here, the possibility of being wrong about whether you're happy or not.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Topic today is happiness, and our guest is Robert Solomon, professor of philosophy at the University of Texas, author of many books on emotions, happiness, and related issues. Bob, so objective kind of can have two meanings. Sometimes it just means that there's something about the world that makes it true or false. It's not just up to what we think. Sometimes it has a slightly weaker or slightly stronger meaning, which is that there's really wide agreement. So I guess you're saying that there can be a lot of disagreement about what happiness is, different cultural things and so forth, but there's always this objective component. It always just depends not just on what's going on in your own mind, but what's going on out in the world, too.
That's right, and that's where I disagree with the last caller. It is not just internal. It is larger than that. But just to confuse the point even more, it seems to me that a whole society or a whole culture could be in self-deception about how happy they are.
Oh, wow, that's an interesting one. Let's have some callers weigh in here, though. Miriam in San Francisco, welcome to Philosophy Talk, Miriam.
Hi, this is a great topic. I was interested in addressing the difference between happiness and contentment, because the two kinds of happiness that you brought up earlier, they seem almost contradictory to me, because the transitory happiness, in order to be remarkable, it would have to be sort of an exceptional in your life, and that would seem to me to come from a more balanced life or contentment perhaps, and then perhaps that balance, that contentment, is actually the good life or the objective, as opposed to any sort of enormous opposite feeling of that transitory happiness.
Thanks, Mary. I'm not quite sure I follow the drift of the question. I mean, it seems I don't see that the contrast between contentment and transitory happiness. I mean, you could have lots of transitory happiness, and you could be content. I don't get it.
Well, I don't know if it's an opposition, but they don't mutually entail each other. You can have lots of transitory happiness and be pretty discontent. I mean, and matter of fact, those do sometimes go together. I'm pretty unhappy, so I'm going to go out and binge and take my mind off it with lots of pleasure. What do you think, Bob?
Well, one of the examples that one of you gave before I came on about just sort of, you know, drinking beer and being content and all that, on the one hand, that is clearly transitory. On the other hand, unfortunately, I know people who have turned that into a permanent state.
Yeah.
So there's a real question here about whether that counts as contentment or not, which introduces the same ambiguity into contentment that we introduced into happiness.
But but you're going back to your artist who is striving to create, and you know, I don't see the essential connection between contentment and happiness anyway. I mean, you could be restlessly striving, but so be discontent in all sort of current states of your life. But mm-hmm. If you believe that by through the restless striving, you're not going to just be endlessly frustrated, but you're going to endlessly achieve new things, new and new things. I mean, that seems to me you could be deeply happy, but not at all content in some sense. So I don't. People often talk about happiness as contentment, but I don't quite get that.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right.
Philip in Brisbane's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Philip.
Oh, hello. Thank you. I have observed, or I think I've observed, that when infants are nearly newborn and shortly thereafter, if they're healthy and loved, they seem to be intrinsically happy. And if you want to include contentedness in that, I think that works. And also that it just weirdly progresses or devolves into this conflicted state of unhappiness the older the human gets. And there's one stage, which is so weird, that in adolescence, where any evidence of unhappiness in a social gathering is anathema, and you can make yourself a pariah. And so it's just such a weird, complicated concept. But basically, I think it's intrinsically at the core of human consciousness as a given. That's my comment, and I'd like to hear what you have to think about that.
Well, I think that raises some really fascinating questions. Although I would disagree with the main point, which is that infants are born sort of naturally happy. If there's any almost universal observation in developmental psychology, it's that some babies are born and they're already beaming, and other babies are born and they're complaining about the world.
Yeah.
And what I find fascinating is that these things seem to stick. And it's a problem for me because I'm an existentialist and I believe in choice and choosing to be happy and all that. And at the same time, I have this painful realization that many people, and myself included, are born with a kind of very low threshold for crankiness and so on. And that makes the kind of bubbly happiness that some people seem to find quite easy and natural impossible.
Well, if Ken and I were two of the seven dwarves, I think he'd be happy and I'd be grumpy.
Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah, I think maybe he'd
on
be
his
deep,
bad
maybe
days.
He'd be deep and I'd be shallow.
No, that's not true at all.
But those weren't dwarves. Let me ask a kind of a connected question. There is quite a body of literature in psychology about happiness, and philosophers mm-hmm. sometimes criticize the psychologists for not spending enough time asking what happiness is. But I must say, in reading it, I find it often quite interesting and persuasive. I want to mention one little book called by a guy named David Niven called 100 Secrets of Happy People or something like that. I delve into this book whenever I go to the dentist's office because it's there in the waiting room, and it's one of the big influences on my life. And he has this interesting factoid in there. I think this is where I got it. If David is not the famous actor, it's some psychologist. If he's listening, it can call in. And that's that if you take the kind of things that you think would really change a person's life and make them happy, winning the lottery ought to be one. And if you think of something that would mm-hmm. Really make a person unhappy, being an accident, becoming a quadriplegic would be one. But according to him, studies show that in the yep. psychological sense of happiness, 2 years after these events, these people have reverted to about as happy as they were before.
That's right.
That seems to me amazing. Yeah. I don't know whether it's depressing or exhilarating.
Well, there's this guy named Ed Diener who has done a lot of this research. And one of the things that he argues, and I think it's really fascinating from a personal point of view, among other things, is that it's almost as if there's some sort of rheostat in the brain that sort of sets the level of happiness that you've got. And I hate to sound like a determinist here, but basically that's kind of it. And that sort of is your sort of fallback level. So mm-hmm. even if terrific things happen to you, like winning the lottery, or even if horrible things happen to you, like a debilitating accident, you sooner or later get back to that basic point. Now, one of the interesting sort of complications here is that there are folks who have been working with the Dalai Lama, thinking of Richie Davidson at Wisconsin, for example, who claim that through certain kinds of meditation and so on, you can actually reset the rheostat.
Yeah. You know, you guys are making a thought bubble up in me here. you can, before I tell you my thought, I let our callers know that they can join this conversation. We welcome your calls at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or go to our website, www.philosophytalk.org, and if the internet starts to cooperate, we may be able to get your online comment. But
so Ken, let's get this bubble burst before your head blows.
Yeah,
up.
Yeah. But look, so you know, maybe people are just, if you believe that you had complete power over your life, if you could make your life be whatever you wanted it to be, then you know you should let your happiness go with your success or failure at making your life what you want it to be, right? But suppose you don't have complete power over your life. Suppose you're just stuck being a paraplegic. Maybe the reason that the level of happiness isn't affected by that outcome is because we're designed to take satisfaction in our life to the extent that we can't control, you know, where our life goes. I mean, why go around being miserable and sad and unhappy if you can't do anything about it? Maybe that's a trick of evolution. Bob, what do you think about that thought that I just... Hmm. This is the first time I thought that.
Well, Bob's an existentialist. That means we always we always have the freedom to do anything. But do we have the freedom to be happy just by deciding?
Or to be unhappy.
I'm torn. The son of a friend of a friend had a terrible diving accident a couple years ago. Was paralyzed from the neck down. And this is a kid. He's 15 or 16 mm-hmm. years old. And for the first year after the accident, he did nothing but sulk and mope, and I'm sure would have committed suicide if he knew how. And finally, his friends said to him, look, I mean, this is the way you are. Get over it and figure out how to live your life. Now, that sounds pretty harsh, but it's the only sort of advice that makes any sense.
Well, with that, let me say this is Philosophy Talk, and we're talking to Robert Solomon about happiness. And you can join our conversation by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. We'll be right back.
Every life we have some trouble, but when you worry, you make it double. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy now.
Don't worry, be happy. Advice from Bobby McFerrin. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're joined today by Professor Robert Solomon from the University of Texas at Austin, who's written a lot about happiness and the emotions. We're talking about the happiness, obviously, and we'd like to hear from you. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. And Brendan in San Francisco did just that. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Brendan.
Hello. I just wanted to bring up the subject that I think, well, even Aristotle is known heavy drinker. And in present day, people use Prozac. Everybody's always been looking for something to ingest or digest to make them happier. And I just wanted to bring that up as a comment to talk about that. Even, I mean, the pharmaceuticals are making millions of dollars off of the research to make people happy.
So, and you think that's a good thing, a bad thing? What are you worried about this?
I'm just bringing it up as a question. That's all. Just something to comment on.
Okay,
that kind of suggests a general question I thought we might want to move into. Are some kinds of happiness superior to other kinds of happiness? Is the happiness of somebody who's sitting around imbibing mead or whatever it was Aristotle drank equal to the happiness of a person who gets their jollies by helping less fortunate people? Or we misconceived that question.
Bob, what do you think?
Well, again, I could push back to the first point, which is that the word happiness, and you've said quite a few things of this sort, but the word happiness is kind of hopeless. It always sounds, and this comes from Aristotle, as if it's a single, all-embracing, the good in life. And it's really not. And even going back to where you started in the introduction with the idea of happiness and emotion, I'm tempted to say that we think about the emotions in a simplistic way, too, and even breaking them down into thoughts and feelings, which is a great improvement over just talking about them as feelings. Nevertheless, it's still much too simple-minded. And I think part of the simple-mindedness is we think that there's a kind of polarity between good and bad, pleasure and pain. And if you think across the sort of spectrum of human emotions, including happiness, nothing's that simple. That you think about most of the emotions that define most of our lives, they just don't fall into such simple-minded categories.
Yeah.
And I think the notion of happiness is sort of prey to that simple-minded polarization of human life. You're happy or you're not happy.
So let's help us think about it in a less simple-minded fashion. I mean, we talk, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as if happiness was a noble, important, morally deep, morally significant pursuit, right? But if it's this, but I'm not quite sure, given what you just said, that we're justified in thinking about it that way. I mean, there are lots of goods in life, and happiness is maybe one of them, and maybe not such an important good. Aristotle, like you said it was the highest good, but and it's the only thing we pursue, you know, merely for its own sake.
Did Aristotle say that?
Something like that, right? Didn't he say that?
Aristotle said that.
Yeah, I mean, but that you're making me believe that that's much too simple-minded. Help me think about it. Help me think about the place of something more nuanced in a good life that you would like to call happiness.
First, let me ask you two scholars a terminological question. Now, Aristotle's Greek word for happiness is often not translated by philosophers because they think it's such a good idea and better than our word happiness. What is it?
Eudaimonia.
Yeah, that's it. What did is that translated as happiness pretty good, or is it a somewhat loftier conception?
No. The way it's usually translated by the people I read now is as flourishing, or simply doing well. And that sort of builds in the objective component I was talking about.
Absolutely.
And it makes it very clear it's not a feeling.
Yeah. Okay. So what is so happiness is not part of doing well? Happiness is part of doing well? I mean,
For Aristotle, happiness is doing well.
No, I mean, I know. I'm talking about for you, the truth now. I'm not talking about Aristotle scholarship. I'm talking about how should our listeners think about the truth about this in a nuanced, sophisticated way that won't be charged with simple mindedness?
I'm tempted
to stick with Aristotle. It seems to me that the only kind of happiness that's worth taking seriously is something like doing well. And the sort of transitory feeling you get from whether it's a couple drinks or Prozac over a long period of time really doesn't measure up.
Yeah. Do you think, okay, well, let's see if our callers agree with you or disagree with you. Tom in Oakland, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello. This is Tom in Oakland.
Hi, Tom.
I was just kind of waiting for the old buzzword of self-actualization.
Okay.
Which I hadn't heard, although the idea of doing well...
It comes pretty close.
To that,
yeah.
There was a researcher, Mahali, Csikszentmihalyi, who used to research peak experiences, and he found people who did really well at an activity, whether an athlete or it could be just some menial work activity, but they did focus on getting that incremental best, that was better for them. You know, personally, I found when I'm either being very creative or just doing incrementally better at something that I'm really focused on, that gives me that sense of kind of timeless peace, contentment, fulfillment, whatever it is.
So this idea of self-actualization means you've got certain potential and talent, and you can kind of choose to spend your life or your day either doing something with those or nothing. And it's
right.
been used in philosophies. There's an ethical kind of self-actualization, that what's right to do is to actualize yourself. You're saying there's also this kind of theory of happiness based on what makes you truly happy is to actualize yourself.
Yeah, fulfilling. And if you could translate that to a national level, some countries talked about a national index of happiness rather than, gross national product, that I guess if you could get your citizens, give them as much opportunity to fulfill themselves, in a way that's helpful to everyone.
I find that a little frightening. In the 19th century, not to mention the 20th and 21st, we had this American idea of imminent, manifest destiny, which was a very self-actualizing notion, I think, led to all kinds of trouble. And don't you think self-actualization is kind of a nice theory for talented people? But how about the rest of us who don't have that big a self to actualize? Can't we just aim at contentment?
I'm not so much saying I'm going to roll over everybody else, but to give not just a few people the opportunity to rule over everyone else, but to get everyone a chance to fulfill themselves in their daily lives, whether it be at work or some of their activity.
Thanks.
Give everybody a larger, not just in the country. But
well, you've given us a lot to mull
Thanks,
over
Tom.
There.
So, Bob, you got any reaction to that at all?
Yeah, I think gross national product is a terrible way to measure happiness.
Yeah. Well, yeah, me too. Hey, look, though, I want to add the self-actualization for flourishing and all that. I can't you imagine? It doesn't seem right to me that that's happiness, because you can imagine a person doing well in some sense, but being deeply miserable. That is, they do well. You know, Aristotle thought you had to do well for yourself, not just for yourself, but for your circle, your friends, your fellow citizens. All you do well. I mean, you're virtuous. You make the world go better, and you in some sense
develop your talents.
You develop your talents, but you could still be. I mean, awful things could happen to you. I mean, people could betray you, cheat you, but you're still doing your best. But would you be happy? No, I don't think so.
Not necessarily.
No, so it seems to me that doing well is different from happiness.
Well, but I think I'm tempted to say, in the sort of happiness that I'm talking about and Aristotle's talking about, doing something like fulfilling your potential or something like that really is a kind of necessary condition for happiness.
Right. Is it sufficient, though?
No.
Let me go back. You kind of agree with both Aristotle and Nietzsche about a lot of things.
Yep.
Now, one thing that, and I'm not a big reader of either of them or much of anybody else, but anyway, my vague impression is that with Nietzsche...
You learned everything he has to know from me telling him.
Yeah, that's right. With Nietzsche, there's more of a sense of joy as a component of the whole thing. And, you and Bob, we go back about 40 years. I don't want to betray your age to the radio audience here, but mm-hmm. when we were young professors assistant professors at UCLA, joy seemed an important part of everything.
It was also the 60s,
right?
Oh, okay, so, let's kind of get into that, guys.
Yeah, so how do you merge this the need for occasional episodic moments of joy with the overall theory of happiness in your own life and in your philosophy?
Well, I think the talk about self-actualization here makes some sense. I think those moments of joy come when you've realized some deep project. If I just am sort of doing some inane activity and somebody approaches me and said, you've just done that faster than anyone else in the world, my response will probably be, huh? Because it doesn't matter. It wasn't a project of mine. I didn't aspire to anything. So there's not going to be a joyous moment. The reason why runners and athletes in particular, but also musicians and so on, have these ecstatic moments is because at a certain point they really feel as if they fulfilled a potential. And Nietzsche certainly, when he did experience joy, listening to music, for example, and clearly when he was writing sometimes, it's because it fit into his general vision of his life. It wasn't just a momentary feeling that came out of nowhere.
Well, Bob, this conversation has been making me very happy. I'm unhappy we didn't get to more of our callers who've been waiting on the line, but our guest has been Professor Robert Solomon of the University of Texas. He's author of many books, including the recent book Thinking About Feeling, Contemporary Philosophers on Emotion. Bob, thanks a lot for joining us on Philosophy Talk.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Bob. It's been great talking to you.
So, John, are you happy?
Oh, I'm a pretty happy guy for a grumpy guy.
Yeah. Well, what did you learn about happiness today? Well, what's your thought?
Well, my thought is, of course, we always learn that whatever we're talking about is a lot more complicated than we thought when we started, even if we thought it was complicated when we started.
Ain't it the truth?
But I think I learned quite a bit from Solomon. He's really thought about this stuff for a long time. It's this objective-subjective divide that seems to come up with so many problems in philosophy, and it really seems to come up with happiness.
Yeah, you know, I guess I've come to the view, I didn't have it before we started this discussion, so I've come to the view that the happiness is almost a useless concept. I mean, there's so many different things you could say about it, there's so many different views about what role it has in an overall good life, and it seems to me that Bob was making the point, although he wouldn't really own up to it, that we need just more notions to evaluate human life by. You know, there's self-actualization, there's the good outcome of your action, there's virtue, there's all kinds of stuff. And I don't think they all add up to one thing, unlike Aristotle.
Yeah, but you may be asking a little bit much of our concepts. Take those big three: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, life, liberty, happiness, those are all concepts that are pretty fuzzy around the edges and more complicated. You might have thought life was pretty simple, but if you look at the issues about abortion and stem cell research, and is being alive the same as being a human, is being human the same as being a person, our concepts can be useful by leading us into philosophy where we understand them better. Matter of fact, maybe that's most useful a concept can be.
I agree with you. But take your distinction between subjective and objective well-being, right? They can come apart. Somebody can be objectively bad off but have great subjective feeling. They can be subjectively miserable but be objectively bad off. I mean, which should we call happy? I don't think there's any determinate answer to that. So I don't know. It doesn't seem to me to make a whole lot of difference, the term happiness. But your distinction is a great one. And some of the distinctions Bob was getting at, they're great ones too.
So we've learned that happiness is the centerpiece of Aristotle's philosophy, the thing to which all people aspire, and that it's a pretty useful and multifaceted and ambiguous concept. That's pretty good for one day.
Yeah. Next up, Ian Scholes with a 60-second history of the philosophy of happiness.
Ian Scholes, there are two basic views of happiness, utilitarian and hedonistic. Utilitarian dates from Aristotle and views happiness as an offshoot of one's ethical responsibilities, if fulfilled. As John Stuart Mill put it, the greatest good for the greatest number. Make many happy, you will be happy in return. Still, there have been comedians who made many people happy and were miserable themselves. The hedonistic strain says, do whatever makes you happy. This dates from the Greek philosopher Epicurus, who wrote to a friend, we must exercise ourselves in the things which bring happiness, since if that be present, we have everything. And if that be absent, all our actions are directed towards attaining it. Still, things that make us happy can also give us hangovers and STDs. And what is happiness? Curling up with a book? A basketball game? For behaviorists, it's all just positive reinforcement. Give us tasty pellets, we'll be content. For mechanists, it's all just a matter of dopamine production along our mesolimbic pathways. Happiness can include everything from ecstasy to quiet satisfaction. It spans both smirk and titter. It can be briefly found both in a light buzz and a heroin smackdown. Both monk and harlot can achieve happiness. Happiness can even be found in guilty pleasures. One of the unalienable rights we have as Americans is the pursuit of happiness. Not the right to happiness itself, I guess, but to snoop around for it. Which brings us to the paradox of hedonism, formulated by the 19th century utilitarian philosopher Henry Sidgwick. It can be stated this way: when one pursues happiness itself, one is miserable. But when one pursues something else, one achieves happiness. The Buddhists turn this paradox on its head. As part of their belief system, when we give up all desire, all pursuit of happiness, only then will we achieve happiness, or nirvana. In recent years, there's even sprung up Christian hedonism, which posits that we need not feel guilty about desire, so long as what we desire is the eternal pleasure of God. In the 20th century, modern psychology gave us a kind of mental hedonism in the theory that we are all motivated by basic self-interest and aversion to pain. Of course, many claim that this kind of egoism gave us both the swinging 60s and the cocaine culture of the 80s. But as Blaise Pascal wrote, all men seek happiness. This is without exception. The will never takes the least step but to this object. This is the motive of every action of every man, even of those who hang themselves. And there's the thought that ought to cheer you up. I gotta go.
If you'd like to share your own philosophy of happiness, head to the philosophytalk.org and join our forum.
Philosophytalk.org also has links to our conundrums page. We love to get conundrums, philosophical problems that are bugging you, the nature of time, of good, of virtue, or some moral issue that's upsetting your life. You can submit a question for Ken and me to discuss with you on the air.
Well, we can't promise we'll solve your problem. As a matter of fact, we promise we won't solve it, but we will give you lots of ways to think about it.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2004.
Our executive producer is Gordon Earl.
Special thanks go to Peter Crimmins, Nicole Sawaya, Roman Mars, and Dwayne Brown.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Hoover Institution, the Greenwald Foundation, and the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
And also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW Information Radio 91.7, San Francisco's oldest FM station where our program originates.
The views expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders or any unhappy or happy person in the world.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.